Hi there, I'm Alistair Madden and you're listening to Season 5, Episode 12 of the Road to Nowhere European Football Podcast. In this episode, we appraised José Mourinho's spell in charge of Roma. We unpacked the factors behind Jadon Sancho's bittersweet Bundesliga return, and we dissected Almeria's controversial Bernabeu heartbreak. We looked at all of those topics and so much more in our usual detailed way. Do go and check out the show notes for a comprehensive running order of what we discussed and when. This episode is, of course, produced in partnership with Freelance Football Ops. If any of our listeners are freelancing in football, you may be interested in signing up to Freelance Football Ops' subscription-based newsletter. They find jobs which cover writing, design, video, audio, and generally anything in football media every week. For more info, visit freelancefootballops.com or follow at FFOps on Twitter. Right, on now with the episode. Hopefully you are all staying safe. Hopefully you are all staying well. Thanks, as always, for your continued support. Enjoy. It's a rather windy evening in Scotland tonight. Rudy Barlow joins us from Madrid. Barlow, is it windy in Madrid or is it fairly calm over there?
Mostly tranquil, it has to be said. I mean, I think, to be fair, it did say, it reliably informs me via Google that it's 16 degrees outside. Sadly, I've been stuck indoors all day doing flipping work, so I've not been able to enjoy it. That's been the first of the kind of temperate climbs coming back to Madrid. But yeah, a little more cram than it is at home, I think.
Yeah, it's been pretty wild over the last few days, and it looks like it's going to be wild over the next few days as well. Yeah, no rest for the wicked, Barlow, when it comes to the weather. Now, you mentioned there you've been really busy over the last few days, and that's probably because there's been so much to talk about in Spain. And I think with that in mind, we should probably start with a look at the latest goings on in La Liga. Now, undoubtedly, Jude Bellingham is the face of La Liga this season, but if there is one player who can genuinely challenge him as the best player in the country this year anyway, it has to be Antoine Griezmann. The Atletico Madrid forward was forever in Lionel Messi's shadow at Barcelona, but the latest Madrid derby saw him do something that would not have looked out of place in the Argentine's highlight reel. Barlow, you were at the Metropolitano for the game. Tell us about Griezmann's magic.
Yeah, and what a game too. I mean, it was the first extra time that I've seen live in a stadium, and it was frightening. It was such a good atmosphere. I mean, Atleti were obviously out for revenge after the Supercopa, and you got that real contrast between a stadium of 70,000 fans, all of which were Madrid or Atleti fans, as opposed to in Saudi Arabia, where you kind of had, I think it was about 25k in the stadium, Al-Hilal Stadium, for that one, and it really was. It was a fine atmosphere, but it didn't quite have that same edge as it did at the Metropolitano. You're talking about a game where Atleti take the lead on two occasions. They concede on two occasions. They concede in the 84th minute, and you get that feeling. I mean, bearing in mind in the Supercopa that Real Madrid had equalised in kind of the last kind of 5 minutes or so of the game, then gone on to win an extra time. You very much got the feeling, or you got the fear, if you were an Atleti fan, certainly in the Metropolitano. There was a little bit of a run. There was a little bit of a concern running around the stadium that would happen again. And that is kind of Real Madrid's prerogative. That's what they do to teams. They handle those moments. They handle those kind of ends of the game very well. But Atleti managed to hold out, to hold on. And I don't know if they were necessarily that much better than they were in Saudi Arabia. I don't know if they were necessarily a different team, but they did compete better. And one of the things that Cholo Simeone said in the build up to the game, was said that, right, okay, as a team, if we're going to defend better, then what we need to do is win our battles, win our challenges basically and be stronger than them in the challenges. And I think sometimes we forget that with Atleti, with teams that don't have the same resources as Real Madrid, one of the ways you can equal that, or one of the ways that you kind of have to equal that, is by being sharper, by being up for it, by making sure that you bring more energy to the game and more kind of battling spirit to it than them. Because otherwise, quality-wise, I mean, Real Madrid, in theory, should win every game in Spain because they've got more quality than anyone else right now. So yeah, that was kind of a key part of it for me, for Atleti and for Diego Simeone. It played out on the field. And then enter Antoine Griezmann. I mean, we've spoken so much about him of late, and particularly I think a lot of people in Spain feel a bit of a need to kind of do him a bit more justice, to kind of give him his prop, because he doesn't necessarily get it outside of Spain. And so with Griezmann, one of the things that we praise about him so often is the fact that he's unselfish, the fact that he works so hard, that he's so kind of, he has such a good defensive work rate. He's a real team player. He's a star in kind of a workman's body. He doesn't necessarily cut that figure. But in terms of kind of a moment here, you really got I am the man kind of thing here from Griezmann. He scored a brilliant, brilliant goal in the Supercopa against Madrid, where he kind of sits Luka Modric down. It's a really nice turn away from him. And that was the goal that broke the record of Luis Aragonés. It made him outright the top scorer in Atletico Madrid history. This is a guy that's obviously had two spells at the club, but has had lengthy enough spells elsewhere at Real Sociedad and Barcelona, of course, in his past. And then this goal, I mean, you could barely have drawn it up better for Atleti and for Diego Simeone. Vinicius has the ball in his own half. Griezmann kind of nicks it away from him after a heavy touch by Vinicius. And one of the things, I mean, it was mentioned by Sid Lowe, but it's really quite enjoyable to watch, is Diego Simeone talking about it, because he kind of takes you through the goal. And the way he does it is as if he's kind of reliving it, and there's a smile on his face as he's doing it. He's saying that he gets the ball and then he's running away from Vinicius, but Vinicius is fast, Vinicius is strong, but then he gets his body in the way. Then he's got the byline and it looks like he's going to run out of space. And then kind of, yeah, just arrows it into the top corner from no angle at all. It was a moment that it belonged to a big player, and it was the sort of thing that you imagine Leo Messi doing. And Griezmann, yeah, shirt off, wild celebrations from the fans. They eventually get another from Roro Riquelme in the dying moments, and that kind of seals it, a 4-2 win for Atleti. But yeah, it was symptomatic of an Atleti side that kind of overcame where you'd worry about them. So, I mean, they have a really good attack. I mean, Alvaro Morata and Antoine Griezmann have 37 goals between them this season. That's more than any other duo in Europe, not Harry Kane and Sané, not any of the others from City or from the Premier League either. So you've got one of the best attacks in Europe right now, but that defensive fragility, that kind of, yeah, real kind of weakness or real kind of rigidity, that they just don't seem to quite be able to put the two together. They overcame that against Real Madrid, and I think being a derby, it obviously helps if you can challenge harder and run a bit more, and the fans are really kind of behind you and really kind of giving it everything for them. But yeah, this was one of those moments that will go down in a long, long and very successful career for Griezmann. This will be on kind of one of the posters for it. And it was a nice moment. I mean, Antoine Griezmann has always been kind of hit with the penalty that he's never really won huge amounts in Spain with Atleti. So, I mean, he's won a Europa League, he's won a Super Cup, he's won a couple of trophies, but nothing kind of out there. And I think a Copa del Rey here, if they could get through, I mean, they're in the quarterfinals now against Sevilla, Barcelona, and Athletic are kind of the two big other teams that are really in form playing against each other. Girona are still in it as well. But if they can get through, they have a good chance of winning this Copa del Rey. And I think even if it's not a La Liga title, which is the one that I think Griezmann would really, really like, it would be just reward for his performances over the last kind of year and a half, if he were to get a trophy for Atleti, if he were kind of to be the poster boy for it as well. And yeah, just kind of hats off to Griezmann and Atleti and Real Madrid for putting on the best shows. I mean, the previous game was 5-3, this one was 4-2, two extra times. Really, really good games between them all. I think Toni Kroos didn't start either of these games. I couldn't understand that from Carlo Ancelotti, because they were much, much better when he was on the park. And as he kind of grows towards what presumably is his retirement or the end of his kind of Real Madrid career, I get more and more kind of enamoured with the things that he does, the way that he changes the game for Real Madrid. I'd say in these last 2-3 years, he's almost played better than he has in the kind of 2-3 years preceding that, where I guess Modric was probably more of the star and perhaps Kroos was doing the same things, but you noticed it less because Modric was there. And so, yeah, he was brilliant. Bellingham was obviously brilliant as well. And Atleti managed to exploit kind of a weakened defence by injuries, as we've talked about in the past. But yeah, hats off to Diego Simeone, because this was a really big, felt very momentous win. And these are kind of the nights that Atleti fans live for. So yeah, it was a great occasion, and hats off again to Griezmann.
Lovely stuff, Barlow. Now, the latest instance of the sacking siren going off in La Liga means that we are taking a closer look at one of the clubs in the bottom half of the table. Quique Sanchez-Flores remains safe at Sevilla for now, but further south, Sergio González is out at Cadiz after 2 years. Since coming back up, their two sackings have, however, been fairly unique cases, Barlow.
Yeah, they've been unique because they've been pretty amicable. I mean, you don't rarely get managers kind of accepting their sacking, as Sergio did, and the same with Álvaro Cervera before him. Two managers that have really identified with Cadiz, that have really identified with the team and the town, or the city, and they've been really kind of close to the fans and to the chairman. I mean, he had a tearful goodbye in his press conference he had on Monday. Manuel Vizcaíno, who's the president, was there. He gave him a hug. He said it was very amicable when he kind of made the decision, that he understood it. And the pair of them were really kind of very somber about what happened. I mean, Vizcaíno said it's a failure of the kind of sporting department if we're sacking the manager. And Sergio said kind of just after his last game against Alaves, where they went down 1-0, and really kind of the writing was already on the wall, but that kind of nailed his coffin shut in that sense. And Sergio was very sanguine about it. He was very kind of honest. He said, look, I've been here before. I mean, we're 17 games without a win. They've not won since the 1st of September. So he's done well to last this long. He's had the faith of the board, and they've given him time to sort this out. But yeah, ultimately had to go. But I think it's rare, and I think it's to be applauded that people can kind of see in this case with Cadiz and the way that things have gone with Cervera, first of all, who was loved, really, really loved. I mean, the way the fans came out for Cervera in the past was fantastic. And Sergio came into this in a really difficult position because he was replacing Cervera, who was so beloved, such an iconic figure for the town. I mean, you've got people who've got tattoos of Cervera's kind of sayings, and Cervera's, I think there's a house named after him, after one of his sayings as well. So yeah, somebody that really identified, and Sergio kind of kept the miracle going. I mean, he kept them up last year in reasonably good fashion. I mean, they were down to the last day, but they were kind of always in control of their own fate. And again, in that first season, he kept them up as well. And so that has to be a good job for a side that in Cadiz, they've got one of the lowest budgets in La Liga. I think it's still in the bottom three in terms of budget. And they also have probably, I mean, Paco Bolit, my colleague, was saying that probably has the worst squad in La Liga too. They don't really have any goal scorers. They've got Chris Ramos, who's a good, hard-working striker. They've got Darwin Matthews, Brian Ocampo, players that are kind of useful in La Liga, but not players that are going to guarantee you goals. And you look around them, I think Las Palmas are doing outstanding work with García Pimienta. That's kind of an anomaly. But Alaves are the other side, who obviously they were beaten by, who I'd say have similar levels of quality in their side right now. And yeah, Cadiz just aren't able to keep up with them. Granada and Almeria are two in the bottom three with them, but I'd say even they have kind of better quality than Cadiz do. So it's going to be a real tough job for whoever comes in. And I guess in a sense, Cadiz have been living within their means, which is laudable and the right thing to do. But ultimately, if you don't have that investment, and if you're always kind of relying on a little bit extra from the coach or a little bit extra from kind of the spirit, your home fans, then you do run the risk of kind of falling into this and into kind of a real relegation dogfight, which they're going to be in every year. but it's going to be very, very tricky for whoever comes in.
Indeed, Barlow. Now, we know Spanish football has a flair for the dramatic, but the latest refereeing controversy has provoked considerable hysteria. What happened and why has the aftermath been so damaging for everyone involved, Barlow?
Yeah, crikey. I mean, never a dull Sunday night in Spanish football. Almeria went down 3-2 to Real Madrid, and at the Bernabeu, they were 2-0 up at one point. Almeria were playing quite well, playing really good football. Bear in mind, this is a side that's drawn 6 games all season. They've only 6 points all season. They've not won yet. They were 2-0 up at the Bernabeu, playing pretty well and looking like they were on course for not only a historic victory over the Bernabeu, but one of perhaps the great upset of the season. I mean, as I was saying, a team that's down and out, probably getting relegated, has no wins, has really struggled all season. And even though they've done kind of, they put up a fight against a lot of teams, they think they've got more quality than their results show. To go into the Bernabeu and to have beaten this Real Madrid side would have been something for these fans to hold on to, something for them to get excited about, and a memory for them to take from this season, which has been hard for them. So you get that kind of context, and that's about 50, 60 minutes in, and then it all comes crumbling down. Almeria, on 3 occasions, the VAR intervened to overturn decisions in Real Madrid's favour. One of them was a disallowed goal for Almeria. There was a foul in the build-up on Bellingham. I think the refereeing experts have all kind of agreed that that one was a foul. That was the correct decision. But they do get a penalty for a handball. The handball itself is fine, but the VAR doesn't seem to take into account a push that happens on the Real Madrid, on the Almeria defender before that. You can debate that one, but it's still controversial and certainly far from clear and obvious. And then the third one is a Vinicius goal, which he says his shoulder's in, and there's one angle where it does look like it comes off his shoulder, but there's another angle where he very much looks like he arms the ball in. And that gets overturned and given in favour of Real Madrid. And Almeria are outraged, really kind of outraged. There's also one where Vinicius appears to hit the Almeria defender in the face with his elbow. He's kind of jostling with him, and then he puts his arm up, and then Pozzo catches one in the face. And that doesn't get kind of checked out by the VAR either. So, I mean, Almeria are up in arms. Apologies if you can hear that very yappy hound in the background, everyone. Clearly, the hound is also up in arms about Almeria's lost points on Sunday. But yeah, Almeria are up in arms. They're posting some pretty hilarious social media content about robberies and stuff. I mean, Garitano gets sent off, the manager. After the game, Marc Pobil came out. He's one of the Almeria defenders and said, somebody above clearly didn't want us to win, and that's what happened. I have nothing more to say. Gonzalo Melero is another player for Almeria. He's looking at a long ban, probably, because he said that it's a robbery, that the referees clearly helped Real Madrid kind of thing. Really kind of contundente, powerful statements coming out of this. Ancelotti, for his part, said that they got it all right, which slightly, I mean, he said he understood their frustration. I think it's hard to argue the Vinicius one for me. And that's where kind of the controversy comes in, is because after this, the following day, the VAR audios are being released now by the Federation for each kind of VAR intervention. It didn't show all of the angles to the on-field referee when he was making the decision on the Vinicius handball, which is pretty inexplicable in itself. And then the following day, another audio was leaked from an incident that wasn't released by the RFEF. So they've somebody in within them has leaked this information, and it shows that he sees the Vinicius incident where he kind of elbows Pozzo in the face. He sees that, he says he lifts his arm, he says he catches him in the face, and then proceeds to say, continue, nothing there. And predictably, I mean, Spain is full of conspiracy theories. We've obviously got the Negreira case running in the background, and all of this has kind of kicked off, inflamed. But it's a real problem for Spanish football, the fact that the RFEF have a leak, the fact that teams are kind of really not believing in the... I think faith is at an all-time low in the referees right now. And personally, I think it's incompetence. I think maybe there is an aspect of kind of the pressure that both Barcelona and Real Madrid put on referees. And if there is an injured party, it is the other 18 teams, in descending order of how big those clubs are. But yeah, it's been chaotic. The fallout is likely to rumble on for weeks and weeks. And it's another incident which does not paint Spanish football in a good light. And I think really for me, turns fans off from football, because you look at that, you see what on the face of it probably for most people looks like an injustice, regardless of whether it's right or not. I mean, three VAR decisions in a row going Real Madrid's way is pretty unheard of. If it's the first time in La Liga history it's happened. You add into that the Vinicius incident. Real Madrid fans, I mean, I'm sure they'll have their kind of views on this. I'm sure they can make their arguments, but given it was Almeria, given it was the 20th place side, for everyone else, the optics of it, not necessarily the decisions, are just not great. And I think given, yeah, the way that this is leaked out afterwards is going to have repercussions for some time to come.
Yeah, it felt like a significant night for Spanish football. You'd be interested to see exactly how that one pans out, because I don't think we've heard the end of it quite yet, Barlow. Okay, we are going to take a quick break now. Michael Jones is going to join us. He was slightly late getting in from work this evening, so we just started without him. I'm sure he'll have something to say about that, but he'll be joining us very shortly, and yeah, we'll hear all about the latest goings on in Serie A. We'll be right back. Ever since Jose Mourinho arrived to huge crowds across Rome in the summer of 2021, there has always been this feeling that before long we would be dissecting his departure. And on January the 16th, Roma relieved the special one of his duties in really quite underwhelming fashion. His replacement, club legend Daniele De Rossi, began his time in charge with a respectable 2-1 win over Hellas Verona. Looking at the wider picture, has 2024 already been the most eye-opening year in recent memory in terms of Roma's long-term ambitions and credentials under their current ownership, Michael?
I think certainly the relationship that Mourinho had with Roma fans, with the club, and for owners, the owners themselves, and Dan Friedkin and the group that he oversaw during his time at the club, was for the best part a really positive relationship, even if results didn't always materialise on the field. And that they certainly didn't. You know, Roma didn't qualify for the Champions League in any of the seasons that Jose Mourinho was there, in those 2.5 years that he was in Rome. But for all that, fan attendances at the Stadio Olimpico were fantastic. The relationship between the fans and the manager were fantastic. Mourinho oversaw the arrival of a number of star-studded players. And of course, he won the Europa Conference League in 2022, which was their first European trophy in over 60 years since the Intercity Fairs Cup at the beginning of the 1960s, and their first major cup for over 10 years as well. And I think with all that on the face of it looking very positive and very special to describe the relationship, for a want of better words, what really undermined this season was his inability to build on the Europa League final that they got to last season when they lost to Sevilla on penalties. And although Roma, it doesn't look disastrous on paper, and I thought the timing was quite interesting, because Roma have had periods across all three seasons where they've undergone really difficult periods of form. This season in particular, they started the season with only one victory in six, and then they seemed to regain their form. They only had two runs of games this season where they strung together more than two wins in a row in October and November, where they had both of those runs of games. And that was followed by a bit of a difficult December where they did beat Napoli, and then they got to January where a defeat to AC Milan was ultimately enough, where AC Milan basically ran rings around Roma. And I think the lack of energy in this team, the lack of composure from Mourinho, has been maybe more so here than what we saw in his last two stints in England, at least, not that they weren't controversial either, but he was sent off five times this season after saying that he wouldn't get sent off this season. And ultimately, enough was enough for Dan Friedkin. That was a relationship that even Mourinho had admitted had become strained. And yeah, now we're in this really interesting position with Roma where we just don't know what their long-term ambitions are going to be as a club. They've obviously appointed Daniele De Rossi, whose managerial experience has been limited. He was the coach of Spal last season, Spal who you may remember from Serie A not too many years ago. They got relegated to the third division in Italy last season into Serie C. And I should point out that De Rossi wasn't largely responsible for that. He arrived in October when they were 13th and he left in February when they were 14th. And then they underwent a really poor run under his Calcio teammate, or Azzurri teammate, Massimo Odo from AC Milan, who oversaw their relegation. But De Rossi's now, he started with a win. It was actually quite an impressive performance, but it really does beg the question as to what Roma's long-term ambitions are. We know already that from the time with Dan Friedkin that they were looking to sort of be a bit of a hub for revival, for established stars. That mirrored the manager, Mourinho, who was looking to wrong the right, or right the wrongs even, of what had gone wrong at Tottenham Hotspur and what had gone wrong at Chelsea and Manchester United. And returning to Italy, somewhere where he'd arguably had his greatest success with the treble in 2010, that was something that looked to be achieved. But now they've got a number of these players who arguably have arrived for Mourinho rather than arriving for Roma. I think realistically, whether Romelu Lukaku, Paulo Dybala, the two most high-profile examples, but you can look elsewhere in the squad as well, and you can look at Paredes, you can look at Rui Patricio, whether these high-profile players would have joined Roma at the time without Champions League football if it were not for Mourinho, is a really interesting one. And then you throw in the abolition of the growth decree, which is going to seriously potentially harm their long-term futures when they're looking for new contracts. With Dybala in particular and Lukaku, it seems highly doubtful now that their long-term futures remain at Rome. So in De Rossi, they've got a relatively unproven coach, although he does have some degree of credibility under his belt. And like I said, they could have scored three or four goals in that victory over Hellas Verona. They missed a number of sitters. Stefan El-Shaarawy was brilliant, so was Lorenzo Pellegrini. He scored the second goal in that game. El-Shaarawy set up the first. Eduardo Bobby was fantastic as well. But how Roma are going to adapt over the rest of the season, whether De Rossi's a long-term plan, I think that will be certainly dependent on results. And then, yeah, going into next season, I think it's really going to set the tone over how Roma now, they're going to have to completely re-strategize because of the financial constraints that they're now under. This is a team that was operating with one of the highest net spends, one of the highest wage bills in Serie A. It seems unlikely without Champions League football, and that's a tall order for De Rossi this season, whether they're going to be able to achieve that, whether this is a type of model that they're going to be able to continue to implement. So whether they could look at high-profile appointments in the future, like Antonio Conte, for example, that's yet to be seen, and I think unlikely. So, yeah, I think I'm really intrigued to see what happens with Roma now. I think, Barlow, I'm sure you will know that from his time in Real Madrid, for example, and Ali too, that Mourinho, when he is at a job, he tends to take most of the focus where that can have its positives and negatives. But yeah, the magnifying glass will be really on Roma now, and it will be on the players, it will be on the management, and it will be on the ownership to see what that plan of action is going forwards. And we're yet to see too much as to what that will be, but relations really need to improve. There was huge protest but there was significant protest at the Stadio Olimpico during the win over Hellas Verona. And now we're in a position where a number of the fans have already turned on the ownership because of the decision to depart with Mourinho. And if that's a realization that that is a detachment from the previous philosophy and the previous plan, then it really leaves a question as to how that can be repaired, that relationship can be repaired, and where they go from here. I mean, for what it's worth, for now, they still have a really capable squad, and I think one of the interesting parallels could be Ole Gunnar Solskjaer when he came into Manchester United after Mourinho, where he, for short term, it worked because he gave those players a kind of freedom to express themselves more than Mourinho did. And whether De Rossi can replicate that kind of thing could lead to Roma to some kind of success this season in the league, because the top four isn't as competitive as it has been in recent years. But yeah, I think ultimately it's going to be a hugely interesting period in Roma, and interesting to see how they get on.
Yeah, Michael, De Rossi and Roma were no doubt aided by Hellas Verona's significantly depleted playing squad when they won that game 2-1. Hellas Verona's squad has been eroded by the sale of several valuable players, including Josh Doig, Isaac Hien, and starboy Cyril Ngonge. These departures would represent concerning developments for any team lingering in the relegation zone, but the factors behind Hellas Verona's recent business paint an even bleaker picture. Tell us more, Michael.
Yeah, unfortunately, it's really worrying times in Verona, not for the first time, but this time it is for Hellas Verona. Now, they're a team that have been marred by financial difficulties over the last 2 or 3 years, in particular due to the behaviour of their owner, Maurizio Sarri, who was under investigation in 2021 by the Guardia di Finanza, which is the financial police in Italy. And that was over him moving all his assets over to a holding company called Starball, saying that he was essentially trying to escape bankruptcy in that sense by moving them over and to keep ownership of Hellas Verona. Now, shortly before Christmas, there was a very unwelcome Christmas present for Hellas Verona fans and Vassetti, when he was, his assets were seized just before Christmas over investigations for bankruptcy, and over that decision that there was the confidence that enough evidence had been found for Starball. The club has since issued a statement saying that that is not the case, and that they, or that, no, that it is the case, sorry, but that it will not be impacting the club's day-to-day operations and activities. But the evidence is very much on the contrary to that, where, like you said, Ngonge, who has been the get out of jail card over the past 2 seasons, he's been huge in keeping them in the division. You may remember they only stayed up via a relegation playoff last season. Ngonge has been absolutely huge to that success, if you can call it that. But then losing the likes of Doig, they lost Haricciano to AC Milan, another 20-year-old right wing back who's similar to Deutsch but on the other side, Isaac Hien to Atalanta for €8.5 million, and experienced players like Davide Farioni and Martin Hungler have also departed to Fiorentina and Granada respectively. But it's, yeah, really, really concerning times for Hellas Verona. The future of the club looks really uncertain, and one of the issues that they've always been in Verona is that the stadium in which they play in, the Marcantonio Bendegodi, is a 40,000-seater stadium, but it's never really been able to accommodate themselves. They've never really been able to capitalise on the size of the stadium. Neither have Chivu, who had a very sad story in Italian football, despite being one of the success stories for much of the 21st century. Only for them to drop out of Serie A in 2019 and then to go bankrupt in 2021. And now they've got a new team, Clevenze, who are, I think, in Serie D. So if both clubs were to go out of business, it would be pretty worrying times. But Clevenze, I'm sure, would get a few more supporters. But nevertheless, yeah, really concerning. It's really unclear what's happening at the moment. There's very little money being spent on incomings. There's just $3 million on a young winger from Fortuna Sittard, where in return they sent over Jaden Braff, who was meant to be a really exciting signing from Borussia Dortmund not that long ago, but Tiani Noslin, a 24-year-old, who I don't think brings the same exciting pedigree to him. Not that Braff's lived up to that potential. But it's, yeah, bleak times. The form under Marco Baroni hasn't been terrible. They recently defeated Empoli in what was quite a big victory, a 6-pointer at the start of the year, but and they gave them a good account of themselves against Roma. Nevertheless, it's really worrying times for Hellas Verona. What they're currently being operated, the club's day to day has been conducted by an accountant on behalf of the state at the moment. So, how this all works is going to be really interesting to see. But it seems like they're going to have very limited resources, and they're not going to be able to reinvest that money that they're generating off key asset stripping. I don't know how else you would describe it at the moment.
Grim times at Hellas Verona. Finally, a quick word on Szymon Zurkowski. The Polish midfielder was once dubbed a future star of the national team, and he has had a pretty incredible 2024, considering the fact that just a fortnight ago, at the time of recording, he was playing in midfield for a side at the bottom of Serie B. How have his fortunes changed in such a short space of time, though, Michael?
Yeah, they've changed incredibly. Zurkowski was on the books at Empoli for 2 years on loan from Fiorentina. He's a player that arrived in Italy in 2019, spent 4 years at Fiorentina before joining Spezia on loan with an obligation to buy last summer. But Spezia just got relegated into Serie B, and Spezia now sit at the bottom of Serie B. And it's been quite the turnaround in Serie B. He played 16 games this season, not scored. And this season, he's played 2 games and scored 4 goals, which for box-to-box midfielder generally would be a stretch, but that seems to be his newfound role at Empoli so far this season. He scored in that defeat to Hellas Verona that I just mentioned, that 2-1 defeat, before scoring not just a hat-trick, but a perfect hat-trick in Empoli's, what I would probably describe as their best victory of the season against Monza, who we're all aware of have been a real success story in Italy over the past 2 years. And in doing so, he became the first Polish player to achieve that in Serie A. And yeah, like I was saying, he joined Fiorentina in 2019 for $5 million, just at the age of 21, and he narrowly missed out on the Poland World Cup squad in 2018 as well. But yeah, since then he's just generally struggled to really impose himself. I think a number of loans haven't helped, and now he's gone back on loan to Empoli, but this time he's had a lovely change of fortune. I think it's really important for him that he finds a permanent home in Serie A. I think those kind of, I don't think, if you look at the quality of his first goal, it's a fantastic volley. It was a testament to the player that is in there, but I think it's a player that needs a permanent home at the top level in Italian football. And I don't think, I'd be surprised if he carries on this exceptional form, although under Davide Nicola, he's known to get miracles out of players and teams, and Empoli will be hoping on that to ensure their survival in Serie A this season. But I think there is certainly the potential for a late bloomer in their career if he is able to sustain some stability in the top flight in Italy.
Lovely stuff, Michael. Oh, very interesting indeed. Yeah, worrying for Hellas Verona, and I think that move comes at probably a good time for Josh Doig. I know certainly that quite a few of our listeners follow Josh Doig's progress, and the move to Sassuolo looks like it could be a healthy one, certainly a healthier move than Marseille might have proven to be. It's a great club, Marseille, but I'm not quite sure it would be the best environment for Doig to play his football right now. Better to develop for a few years at Sassuolo, and then potentially once his skin's a bit thicker, perhaps make that move to Marseille, where the fans are notoriously demanding. Okay, well, we will draw our analysis of Italian football to a close there. Thank you very much, Michael. We're going to take a quick break, and we're going to come back to look at some of the latest goings on in Germany. We're going to talk in particular about the return of one of my favourite ever players, Sasa Kalajic. He's back in the Bundesliga with Eintracht Frankfurt this time around. We'll be right back.
In Germany, the January transfer window has seen Jadon Sancho and Sasa Kalajic return to the Bundesliga. Sancho's troubles at Old Trafford were well documented, and Kalajic's time at Wolves was blighted by injury. The moves on loan to Dortmund and Eintracht Frankfurt, respectively, therefore, seem to come at an opportune moment for both players. So, taking the customary road to nowhere step back, what can we expect from Sancho and Kalajic over the next few months, Ali?
Yeah, Michael, on the one hand, I'm really happy to see Jadon Sancho and Saša Kalajic in particular back in the Bundesliga because they were so fun to watch the last time they were here. But on the other hand, part of me is quite melancholic about their returns because those returns are a reflection of the fact that it hasn't worked out for either of them in England, at least not yet. Anyway, those who have been listening to the podcast for a while will know just how highly I rate Kalajic in particular and how I view him as a veritable road to nowhere cult hero. And I really hoped that he would go on to become one of those streets won't forget type players at Molineux. I'll circle back to Kalajic later in the section, but I do just want to look firstly at Jadon Sancho. I think first and foremost, we could quite fairly describe Sancho and his career so far as enigmatic, given how disastrous his move to Old Trafford back in 2021 has ultimately turned out to be, given how altogether miserable he was during his time there. It would be easy to forget just how magical his first spell at Dortmund was at times, Michael. He was unplayable, he was electric almost, and it did feel like we were watching, yeah, the emergence of the next big thing. He had arrived, of course, at Dortmund from Man City as a 17-year-old all the way back in 2017, just days after the departure, actually, of a certain Ousmane Dembele. I don't think anybody at the club would have imagined that Sancho would go on to make such an impact in such a relatively short space of time. So in the first few months, as you would expect, he was eased into life at Dortmund and given game time with the youth team and the reserves. But by October, he was already making his first team debut, coming on in the closing stages against Eintracht Frankfurt. And Sancho actually spoke about that debut in an interview with 442, and there's one quote in particular that stands out. He said, quote, "I'll never forget my first dribble. I tried to take on their fullback. He tackled me and I dropped to the floor. I couldn't get back up. I thought I'd so much time and could do my own thing. Then bang, I knew I had to release the ball quicker after that." And I think those little insights are always quite interesting just to hear the players' perspectives, particularly with regards to Sancho's debut. I think, notwithstanding that initial setback, that first tackle that he had to endure, I think Sancho was always going to go on and become a special player for Dortmund. I think Dortmund very quickly realised that. They very quickly realised that they had this very special player on their books. So he was given the number 7 jersey, taking that jersey on from the aforementioned Ousmane Dembele. And I think taking on the number 7 jersey would come with a certain amount of pressure at any club. But because he was essentially following in the footsteps of Ousmane Dembele, there was even more pressure than perhaps would ordinarily have been the case. Dembele, whilst it's maybe not quite fully worked out for him ever since leaving Dortmund, he was brilliant as well. But when he was at Borussia Dortmund, he produced 10 goals and 22 assists in one season with the club. So yeah, those were big boots to fill. And yeah, as we know, Sancho more than delivered. He more than filled those boots, so to speak. He scored 50 goals and provided a staggering 64 assists across 4 memorable seasons. He was particularly brilliant in the 2020-2021 DFB Pokal, playing a key role in a run which, of course, culminated with a memorable 4-1 win over Leipzig in the final. And so, Michael, against that backdrop, because it is easy to forget that initial backdrop, Sancho's move to Manchester United in the summer of 2021 felt like such an exciting move for all parties, almost like the next natural step in Sancho's blossoming career. But there was always, and this is easy to say with the benefit of hindsight, but there was always this underlying feeling that it could all unravel, that Sancho wouldn't be a good fit for United, that he wouldn't quite adjust to the different demands of playing in England. Fast forward 2.5 years, and it's abundantly clear now that the move wasn't right for player nor club. Now, Michael, you mentioned that his issues at United had been well documented. There's a bit of debate as to who is to blame, and to be honest, I don't think the player nor the club are blameless. So in the last few months before his move to Dortmund, Sancho, of course, found himself essentially in exile at United. At the heart of it all was this social media post from Sancho calling into question Ten Hag's reasons for dropping him for the game against Arsenal at the start of September last year. I think I was in Wales enjoying the rural Welsh countryside, about 30 degrees Celsius. Anyway, I digress slightly there, but I was having a much nicer time than Jadon Sancho was anyway. And that post was interpreted by the club as the same as accusing Ten Hag of lying. So the club wanted Sancho to delete the post, which he did, but they also wanted him to make an apology, which be made publicly to Ten Hag, which Sancho was not quite prepared to do. And the situation was, because of that, it was left unresolved, and Sancho hasn't played for United since. The club, United, placed him on a personal training programme. There's been speculation that his salary was reduced, although that has been disputed, we should add, by Sancho's camp. And Sancho was allegedly having his meals delivered to him in a lunchbox as he was banned from the first team canteen, which just seems altogether ridiculous. But yeah, in any event, it's not a healthy setup at all for a player's well-being or for a player's development. But Michael, even if you look beyond that really quite unsavoury chapter in Sancho's United career, if we think all the way back to when he first joined the club in 2021, he had an ear infection, which meant he didn't start training with the first team until a week before the start of the season. And that is always going to set any player back. And I think in Sancho's case, he never really got going at all consistently anyway after that initial hiccup. By December 2023, 2.5 years or so after he'd arrived at Old Trafford for about £70 million, it was clear to all, yeah, that Sancho needed something, anything really, to get his career going again. The loan move to Dortmund this month seemed, on paper anyway, like the perfect solution. And since rejoining the club, he's made, yeah, arguably an instant impact, providing 2 assists in 2 games. Now, for context, Michael, a few months ago, Dortmund had reportedly said thanks but no thanks to the idea of Sancho returning to the club on loan, but a worrying run of 6 games without a win in all competitions in December prompted the powers that be at the club to reassess and to decide that something different was needed in attack. And a deal was ultimately done to bring Sancho back to the club. So with that winless December in mind, Sancho was coming into a side that was really struggling, a team that needed a lift, and he's given them exactly that, perhaps more than anything as a result of the fact that he's so evidently delighted to be back. Now, The Athletic wrote an in-depth piece about, I've written several in-depth articles about Sancho's ill-fated time at Manchester United and his positive start to life back at Dortmund. And they spoke about Sancho being back in his happy place, and that does feel really quite apt. When he's settled, when he's content, when he's at ease off the field of play, that's when we'll see the best version of Sancho on the pitch. It will, of course, take time for him to get back to full match fitness, but it does feel like he's in the best environment once again for his own development. Just a final word on Sancho before we turn their attention to Saša Kalajic. It must be really difficult for Jadon Sancho to look at how well his former Dortmund teammates Erling Haaland and Jude Bellingham have done since leaving the Signal Iduna, but that in itself should motivate him to kick on, I think, to use this loan as a real opportunity to rediscover his form, rediscover more than anything else his confidence and his smile, to then kick on and realise that potential he showed earlier in his career. He's still only 23, which is, again, easy to forget. He turns 24 in March, so time is still just about on his side. Turning our attention now to the wonderful Saša Kalajic. I made no attempts on this podcast to hide my admiration for the Austrian striker when he was at Stuttgart 2 or 3 seasons ago. I loved watching him play. He was so unique, so elegant as well for a player of his height, but he also used that height expertly. And there was that run, you might remember, Michael, that he had back at the start of 2021 when it genuinely looked like he was unstoppable. I think he scored something like 8 or 9 goals in 7 or 8 games, and it just felt like a matter of time before he would move elsewhere. So, Michael, we were then both quite excited when Kalajic joined Wolves back in August 2022, but just days after making that transfer, he, of course, suffered that horrendous ACL injury on his debut, no less, against Southampton. That injury kept him out for the whole of last season, but when he scored that late winner at Goodison back in August at the start of the current campaign, I did think he was going to kick on and have a really positive season under Gary O'Neill, and yet, for one reason or another, that just didn't happen. Now, Michael, you're a Wolves fan, and so you're well positioned, very well positioned to comment on this. If we treat last season as a write-off, how might we explain Kalajic's underwhelming impact at Molineux this campaign prior to his loan move back to Germany? Is it purely down to the lasting effects of what was the second ACL injury of his career, or is there more to it than that?
I don't think there's too much more to it. I think it's just a case of a player being really unlucky. He was signed as Wolves' marquee striker, really. Jimenez at that point, although he stayed for another season, wasn't really seen as Wolves' long-term. There were concerns over his recovery from another serious but different injury. And yeah, I was at the game where Kalajdzic did his ACL. It was in stoppage time in the first half, and it felt too soon to be playing him at the time. But that was huge for Wolves because they just had no firepower for the next few months until Lopetegui came in. And then what was really important was that Wolves then had to respond in January, and they had a huge outlay on Mateus Cunha, who has gradually become a really, really important player for this Wolves team. But that, in effect, alongside the blossoming relationships with Frankie Chan and Neto, just meant that there just wasn't the space for Kalajdzic to be in that team, and that Wolves had built their attack on a very mobile front three. And like you said, Kalajdzic is an incredibly mobile player for his size, but I think if you compare him to those three, whether he's got the same level of mobility is there to be questioned. And I think especially since the injury, that is also a really important point to make. And yeah, he looked sharp in pre-season. He scored 2 goals in 166 minutes, also scored the winner versus Bournemouth in the Gary O'Neill derby that I really fondly remember. So he's already got some really huge memories at the club, but he didn't really get a look. And there were so many opportunities when in matches where I thought, especially in the last month or so, when the writing seemed to be on the wall, where he could have been introduced and he wasn't, was a real telling sign. But the words from the club was that he was very professional throughout. There weren't the same incidents that you got with Sancho, regardless as to who was to blame. And I guess the final point I would just make is that he seemed to settle to life in Wolverhampton. His wife had opened an Austrian restaurant in the city as well. And I think there was the hope that, you know, he would be a long-term asset. And I don't think that's the case now. He's already spoken of that pride at Frankfurt and that how much he's relished being an important player, whether the matches will build trust. But I'm a Wolves fan, Wolves fan, and I watch a lot of Premier League football. But what's really nice to see in both these instances, and you know, I hope both players do well, is that there's so much said about the be-all and end-all being that making that move to the Premier League. But I think, you know, there is that real nice sign that a player, you know, might have a difficult period, but there is a natural home for him. And I really hope that is Frankfurt. And yeah, I'll be keeping a really close eye on him. And I know Fabio Silva has also gone out to Scotland to Rangers at the same time. And I don't think I'll be following Rangers as fondly as I will be Frankfurt.
Yeah, Michael, Frankfurt are a great club. They obviously had that Europa League success not too long ago, which was thoroughly deserved. And yeah, I think Wolves' temporary loss will no doubt be Eintracht Frankfurt's gain for at least the next few months anyway. So yeah, he started both Bundesliga games for his new club since joining earlier this month, earning his manager's praise for his role in the 1-0 win over Leipzig before providing an assist in the 2-2 draw away at Darmstadt on match day 18. Now, while that draw away to Darmstadt should absolutely be viewed as 2 points dropped, Frankfurt still find themselves in sixth place, well in contention for a place in Europe next season. So if Kalajdzic can rediscover the form he showed at Stuttgart and, more importantly, stay fit, you would have to back Frankfurt to go on and secure one of the European spots. Okay, well, I think with that love letter to Sasha Kalajdzic, we will draw this section to a close. It's been a joy, as always, Rudy Barlow and Michael Jones. It's been a joy, as always, dear listener. I'll say thank you to you, Rudy Barlow. I'll say thank you to you, Michael Jones. And I will say thank you to you, the listener. Hopefully you're all staying safe. Hopefully you're all staying well. Until next time, goodbye.